All right, hope everybody's well. Okay, we can get started. Good morning. We are fourth parak. We were finishing up Mishnah Yotet, 19th Mishnah in the fourth parak. As I always mention, Pirkei Avot in the Siddur, different iterations of how to the numbering, you know, system. But I think this is the standard one in the Mishnah Shmuel HaKatan Omer, right? We ended last week discussing Rav Kook's beautiful interpretation on Vilna Malshinim. Shmuel HaKatan says we should not rejoice when our enemy falls. And we mentioned how Rabban Gamliel asked who can compose the 19th, what we call today the 19th, blessing of the Shmoneh Esrei Vilna Malshinim. Those heretics and slanderers and lowlifes, they should be destroyed and persecuted. And it's a pretty awful prayer. It's not something we should normally do. But the only person who could do such a prayer would be Shmuel HaKatan. In other words, the Gemara just says, Rabban Gamliel asked, and Shmuel HaKatan said he could. So Rav Kook said, what's the big deal there? Why didn't Rabban Gamliel compose it? And so he says, because only somebody who really loves his enemy can compose a blessing of hatred for the enemy. And only someone who has compassion, right, on somebody can execute judgment and punishment. That's kind of why, this I did not mention last week, right, why, let's say, the chazan, to take a very simple example, the chazan, on Yamim Noraim, the ideal chazan has to be married with, children. Because only people with children really know what mercy is, right? You have a much heightened sense. Maybe that's a little bit extreme, but the assumption is you have a heightened sense of mercy when one has children. That's what you want to daven, or a judge. The same idea. You can't have a judge who doesn't have children because he doesn't know what compassion is. So even though a judge is supposed to do, justice, but even justice has to be done with compassion. So that's I think Rav Kook's beautiful idea that Shmuel HaKatan, only somebody of that attitude towards those who are opposed to the essence of Judaism, only somebody who loves the heretics can complain about the heretics and can say bad things about their, because unfortunately we mentioned Tosfot, I don't think I mentioned this last week either. Tosfot often points out the difference, occasionally we have examples we're allowed to hate in the Torah. That's a whole other subject, a little bit beyond what we are discussing. But it's assumed by almost everybody that none of these laws apply anymore today. That you have to be a great person to be able to hate somebody, and your hatred has to be totally pure. Probably the example I always like to quote the best is the example of the Netziv. If I mentioned this last week, which I don't think I did, please remind me, but the Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Huda Berlin, the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Valazhin Yeshiva for the last, 39 years or so of its existence. I think he became Rosh Yeshiva around 1845, and he closed down Yeshiva in 1892. He died a year later, and I mentioned before he used to give a Parshat HaShavuah shir. That's kind of unusual for a Rosh Yeshiva. They tend to look down on those type of things, But anyway, so he gave, and it's his writings are published in McDevor. So he has an amazing comment on Yaakov and Esav, that when Yaakov tricked Yitzchak, so it says, "Vayechrad Yitzchak, charada gedola ad ma'ot," that Yitzchak had tremendous fear and trembling. And Rashi quotes, he saw the opening of Gehenem open up before him. In other words, he realized at that moment how easy he could be tricked. And maybe he realized Esav had been tricking him the whole time. And the Gemara says, the Medrash quotes that, that was very nice, but it wasn't so good. Because what happened? Vayitzak gedola umara ad ma'od. So that's what Yitzchak did. So that expression appears another time in Tanakh, and that's where else does that expression appear? Vayitzak gedola umara ad ma'od. There may be a word different. Who wants to tell me where else that expression appears in
Megillah?
In the Megillah, excellent. In Megillat Esther, when the Jewish people had a cry after Haman made his decrees, and the Medrash says, the Medrash, they're very... they pick up on everything. They said, this is this payment, payback time. What do you mean? We have to sell, you do a sin, you have to pay. So Okay, why we have to pay for the sins of other people? Again, that's God's calculations. But the Medrash connects the yelling out of Yitzchak, and therefore we had to suffer 1,500 years later in Shushan. Yeah. So then the Zeev asks, I don't get it. Like, why was he punished for tricking Esav and not for tricking like Yitzchak? It's because Esav, that was Esav who cried out that bitter cry. Because Esav cried out that bitter cry, we have to suffer. But he tricked Yitzchak. Wasn't that much worse? He tricked his father, Kivud Avim. Esav is whatever Esav is. You know, he's not on the level of Yitzchak. He's not so bad in the Torah. And the Medrash makes him out a lot worse than he really is. But that's, again, another difference. Marty Lection's been sort of, you know, addressing that general topic, the difference between Pshat and Drash. Midrash has a different role than the Pshats. And the Pshat, Esav's not such a bad guy. But in the Midrash, Esav's a bad guy. Because Esav is not Esav. Esav represents the enemies of the Jewish people, whatever that might be. So why, and the Midrash is playing on that. So what he did to Yitzchak was a lot worse. What he did to Yitzchak was much worse, and Yitzchak was much more worthy. What do you mean, tricked Esav? Esav deserved it, and plus he bought the birthright anyways. Esav sold him the birthright. So then Esav explains, yeah, but you know, when he tricked Yitzchak, he didn't really want to do that. We know that his mother forced him. Okay, so he could have turned down, whatever, but he felt terrible, and it really bothered him. What can he do? That was the only way. Sometimes you have to do things that aren't so right because there's a broader goal. But he felt terrible about it. Esav, he got a little bit of pleasure from giving Esav a knock. You know, he gave whatever he called it. He gave him like a shot in the tuchis. He felt a little good. So he says, for that's a terrible thing. That whenever you have to hurt people, you have to do it. You have to feel awful about it, even when it's Esav. And since Yaakov, when he tricked Yitzchak, okay, he felt terrible. That's what we call an Avera Lishma. We have a concept, the Gemara invests in a few places. It's a fascinating concept. How you apply it is not simple, but the fascinating concept we call an Avera Lishma, a sin done for noble purposes. We all understand that there's an Avera Lishma. And the Gemara says an Avera Lishma is greater than a mitzvah shelo lishma. You know, we go through the motions, you know, we're done and we're half asleep, and we do the mitzvah I have to, I don't really want to. So the Gemara first says an Avera Lishma is greater and more meritorious than a mitzvah shelo lishma. And then the Gemara says, how can you say that? Because we should always do mitzvah shelo lishma. And the Gemara says, okay, it's equal. Whatever, they're on par. But whatever it is, we have a concept of them, an Avera Lishma. Gemara learned to rise that from Yael. That's the main source when she killed Sisra. And so you have this, let's say, in the Israeli army. I know this is a huge issue. You know, a Mossad agent has an affair with somebody in order to get information. I mean, this stuff goes on in the world. And halachic authorities have discussed questions like this for the security of a country. Can you do things that are really horrendous in order to protect? I know you're cringing, and that's totally understandable. But so we have a concept of an Avera Lishma. The problem is the Lishma is hard. To do an Avera, we almost never do it Lishma. So it has to be done for the purpose. So that's why with Yitzchak, it was totally Lishma. He didn't, and he felt terrible about it. So there was no punishment. But with Esav, even if Esav deserved it, he got a little bit of pleasure from hurting his brother. So that's like Binfole Becha Al Tismach. He was a little too happy. And therefore, the Jewish people had to suffer in Shushan. That's how the Medrash picks up on it. What to stress the point. I never take these Midrashim literally, but the point in Midrash is, charming home. The truth of the matter, a number of weeks ago, for those who were at Rabbi Daniel Feldman's course on human relations and halakha, they mentioned a very controversial view of the Chafetz Chaim, very strange view of the Chafetz Chaim. It's little famous because the Chafetz Chaim is the most famous for the laws of Lashon Hara. So the Chafetz Chaim rules that we know that I can talk Lashon Hara in order to prevent harm from somebody. If I know you're going into a business deal with a guy who is dishonest, not only am I allowed to, I'm obligated to call you up on the phone and to warn you. But if it's true. So the Chafetz Chaim says, I can only do that if I'm doing it lishma, if I'm doing it because I really want to help you. But I don't like this guy. you know, and I want to get him. And okay, so now I have an excuse. I have an excuse going into business. So that doesn't work. Then I'm not allowed to talk Lashon Hara. So even when I talk Lashon Hara, even in times when it's allowed and when it's mandated, I have to do it Lishma. So that's very controversial, because a lot of people say, if here we have a, I have to prevent you from harm. So if I'm preventing harm, maybe I don't have to do it. Like, who cares if I'm doing it Lishma? The bottom line is I'm preventing from harm. So, okay, then we can leave that halakhic debate for others, but just to be aware of it. But anyways, let's get back here to Shmuel HaKatan. It should pain us that we have to, that our enemies have to suffer. We all know the cups of wine, but I do want to point out that, it's not because, right? It's not because, in other words, I hear a lot of people say, don't rejoice at your enemy because you don't know who the next guy's going to be. Next guy's going to be worse. You know, they'll get rid of the dictators in Iran. You know, as bad as Rouhani is, this new guy's even worse, right? Right. Sometimes the enemy you know, like, is better than the enemy you don't know. Don't be happy when the enemy falls, because you never know. The next one is worse. So that's not at all what Shmuel is saying. Nothing to do with that. That's who knows. Maybe he won't be worse. That's not what he says. He says the pasuk. First of all, as we mentioned last week, Shmuel HaKatan doesn't say anything. That's the cute thing. He just quotes a verse. He made the verse famous. He made it. So it's attributed to him. It's Shlomo HaMelech who wrote Mishlei, right? So, but we attribute to him. It says Pen Yira Hashem VeRabbeinu. The Mish, because God will not be happy. Why will it's a bad character trait? That's what we've been talking now the whole time. It's a bad character trait to be happy when your enemy falls. And that's why it has nothing to do with practicality, a utilitarian approach that this enemy's bad, but the next enemy's worse. No, that's how it works in the political realm, right? But here we're saying it's a bad midah. It's a bad midah. It's a bad character trait to be happy. It has nothing to do with practicality effects. I think that's an important idea. Now, this is all very nice, but we have a problem. What's the problem? The problem is Mishlei Shlomo Melech contradicts himself. No, that's no big deal. Everybody contradicts themselves, especially Shlomo HaMelech. You read Kefer Kohelet, which the rabbis attribute to Shlomo. Kohelet is so full of contradiction. The rabbis didn't want to put it in Tanakh. It's a book of contradiction, but that's okay. The whole Torah is full of contradictions. And those who say Rabbi Yishmael every morning, the Yud Gimel Midot, V'chein Shnei Ketuvim HaMachshishim Zed Zed Shevu HaKotuv HaShlishi B'neihem. One of the 13 ways, and most people don't study a lot of the other. I don't know the last time some of the Kol Devar She'yah B'Chlal V'Yatzah Min HaKlal Lo Lomed Al Atzmo Yatzah. You know, people, we don't study that way somehow. We know Kal V'Chomer, Gzeivah Shavah. These are the 13 rules of how to read between the lines of the Torah. But one of the ones we can understand is Chein Shnei Ketuvim HaMachshishim Zed Zed. You have two verses that contradict each other. The Torah is made up of total contradictions. The stories contradict each other. The laws contradict each other. I mean, not every law, of course, but I'm stressing in this way sort of to make a point. But you read the Chumash, of course, it's totally full of contradictions. Say everything recorded in Sefer Dvarim is recorded differently than it's recorded earlier in the Chumash. Question is why, and this, of course, we meant this. Why the Bible critics? This is what gives them fuel and ammunition. They're not stupid. Their argument, you know, there are serious contradictions, but our rabbis were all of them, because life is contradictory. So you need ad sheboa ketuva shishi v'chmi beinim. So you have to figure out. Life is not black and white. This yes, this no. No, you have this yes and this no. Same thing. So you have to figure out when is yes and when is no. So that's what the Torah is trying to teach us. That's why the final principle, the culminating principle of how to study Torah is to recognize the Torah is full of contradictions. That's how the only way we can grow, that we analyze the contradictions and we see what applies where. So that the fact that the contradictions all over the place. So what's the contradiction to Minfolei Vecha Al Tismach? No, anybody want to answer me? It's another verse in Mishlei. I don't know if I mentioned this last week. Anybody? Okay, ba'avod rishaim rina. When wickedness is lost, avod rishaim is destroyed. Rina, there's joy in the world. Ah, we love it. when the wicked suffer and they're destroyed, and the Mishnah and Sanhedrin list off, you know, when there's bad, they're suffering to wicked, there's so much happiness, and it's great because, wow, we love it. We love it when a terrorist gets, you know, killed, we rejoice, everything. So what is going on here? Is Bimfolei Becha Al Tismach, which Shmuel HaKadon says, oh, Bavod Rishami, and they're written, I don't know, a few verses apart. This is the 11th parak in Mishlei. I think Bimfolei Becha Al Tismach is in the 24th like chapter. So 13 chapters apart in the book of Mishlei, you have one time Shlomo Melech says we should rejoice when the evil are destroyed, and one time he says we should not rejoice. So okay, we discussed on other occasions, we live with the contradiction, that's fine. You can say it's two opinions. It's a little hard to say it's two opinions because it's the same person. So in the same book, but obviously, so some apply here, some apply there. In other words, both principles are true. Many years ago, Rabbi Basil Herring, I don't know, he was a rabbi in Ottawa many years ago, grew up in South Africa, but he was the head of the RCA for a while, Rabbinic Council of America. He was actually the main editor of the recent RCA Siddur that came out last year. You know, the Rabbinical Council of America put out with Koren, sort of a competition to Art Scroll, if you want to call it that, sort of a more, whatever, it's put out a nice Siddur. I don't know, whatever, how many shuls are buying it, but Rabbi Herring wrote an article a number of years ago discussing this issue on the contradiction between Binfolei Becha Al Tismach and Bavo Rishami. And he gave a number of solutions. Some are obvious, depends, there's evil and there's evil. There's an oye, you know, depends how evil. You reach a point. It's like Rav Soloveitchik doesn't answer the question in J.J. Schechter's book on the keynote on Tisha B'Av we just had a couple weeks ago. So, you know, the power of tshuva. And so we always say everybody can do tshuva. What about a Nazi? Can a Nazi do tshuva? And Rav Soloveitchik raises the question. And he doesn't really give an answer because it's hard for us to give an answer. We're too emotionally connected, especially somebody who's a survivor or a child of survivors. What do you mean forgive the Nazis? They did tshuva. But we know the famous story. We read it on Tisha B'Av about when they were killing Rav Hananya ben Trajan, and the Roman executioner jumped in the fire. He says, if I make the fire higher so I can kill him quicker so he won't have to suffer so much. You'll go to the world to come. So he raised the fire and then he jumped in himself. They told him he can raise the fire. He jumped in and then a heavenly voice came out and said that Rav Hananya ben Trajan and his executioner are going together to Olam Haba, like they're sitting next to each other. It sounded like an Olam Haba. And Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, living two generations later, when the story's recounted, he's crying. He's crying. This is so unfair. Yesh koneh olamo b'sha'achad. Some people acquire their entire world in 1 hour. Rav Hananya ben Trajan, his whole life dedicated to this mamzer, low-life murderer, killer, and he gets to Olam Haba because he did 5 seconds of what tshuva? He killed him faster. What kind of tshuva is that? So that's, I don't know, maybe that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was crying. That's what the Gemara says. He was crying. Yesh koneh olamo b'sha'achad. You can acquire your world in one moment and you can lose your world in one moment. So we have, I don't think he was any better than any of the Nazis. It's a problem. So how far do you carry this notion that, you know, we the evil can come back, but there is Bavo Rishayim evil. Rina, there's sometimes when evil is destroyed, absolutely we rejoice, and there's a mitzvah to get rid of evil. It may depend how bad the evil is, but I think there are other approaches. One could say it's good that evil is destroyed, but nonetheless we shouldn't rejoice about it. And I'm pointing out, that's what I said, Shmuel's not talking practicality, he's talking as a character trait. Yes, we should rejoice, but we shouldn't. There's a difference between Rina and Simcha, perhaps. The Bavad of the version Rina, there's joy in the world when evil is departed, but I personally shouldn't rejoice about it. I understand the distinction I'm trying to make. Yes, it's good that evil is destroyed, but on a personal level, it's not something that for my character development, it's not good that I'm happy about it. It's good globally, But individually, I don't deal with the issue, perhaps. And of course, we discussed it depends if you're doing it lishma or not. You know, bavover shamrina, you know, you have to be doing it for the right reason. The idea is that there it's the a last resort. That's true. But sometimes you have no choice, like God with the Egyptians. Now we know when the angels started to sing that the Egyptians were drowning, God got angry. My creations are drowning in the sea. The Egyptians who enslaved the Jewish people for hundreds of years, and you're singing. But we did sing. We sang as Yashir. There's no problem with that. So it could be if it affects you personally or not. In other words, for someone who suffered at the hands of an evil person, he can be happy when that evil person is destroyed, is hurt. But somebody else, he shouldn't rejoice about that. Perhaps you can, if anybody has other ideas and suggestions, or we can leave it as a contradiction. But I think there is something to that. Obviously, if you're affected personally, it's much, much different. We have different expectations for people. That's why, when I said earlier that a judge has to have compassion. What do you mean? How do you have compassion in justice? That's what you have to have. It's justice, but different. You have to take into account various circumstances, and that's the job of a rabbi, of a dayan, before he issues a ruling, is to know the person. We've mentioned many times, I don't like these computer rabbis. I mean, even if there's a live person at the other end, right? Because if it's a question, a very technical question, fine, you can ask that online. But if it's a question of, that has any social implications or anything to individuals, so how can somebody answer who you don't know by a computer? I don't care how much they know, they have to get to know you. Okay, that's just a little bit to finish off that Mishnah. It's not good character to rejoice when other people are suffering. That's the bottom line. Okay, maybe there are exceptions, maybe there aren't, and we should whenever we have to do something wrong, we have to think really, really, really hard, and we have to make sure we're doing it for the right reasons, and 99.9% of the time we aren't. Because and Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo. It's very hard for us to judge ourselves, but you have to ask sort of a third party if what you're doing is right, because we always are biased to ourselves. That's the way it is to be a human person. Okay, let's see any comments here. I see. It's perhaps not to rejoice in recounting that got this punishment. Ah, very interesting, Carol, right? You say that bin folei vech al tismach is later, but at the moment that they suffer, we're happy, but it's not something to celebrate every year, whatever. Okay, different categories. All right. Thank you. Let's move on to the next Mishnah, one of the most famous or infamous, perhaps, people in all of rabbinic literature, Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya Omer, Halo Alome Yeled Lemahu Domeh, Mishnah 20. Elisha ben Avuya says, one who teaches a child, what's he like? The diok tuvo on the archadash, like ink written on nice new paper. But hello, maids. Okay, niyar. I don't know what niyar means. I doubt it meant paper, because they probably didn't have paper exactly the way we have paper. Probably meant on with a quill on parchment. But I'm just looking at that. I'm not sure what niyar means in the Mishnah. But anyways, the idea is it makes better that it's on parchment. It's more permanent, which is his point. Zog tuval niyar chadash. It's like ink written on new, let's say, parchment. Valomeid zaken, but one who teaches an older person. Lemahu domel yok tuva on the armachok. It's like take your pen and erase paper. It's obviously not the same thing. So basically, we should stop the class and we should invite all the 6-year-olds, because you should be, what are you wasting your time teaching adults? Because it's on erased paper, right? The truth of the matter, I recall Rav Schechter once telling us, Rav Schechter's teaching, the highest levels at Yeshiva University, the future rabbis and whatever leaders of the Orthodox community. And he once commented that, you know, some rabbi teaching grade one, you know, in the middle of nowhere, probably is doing greater work than he's doing, more important work, you know. So, and I remember Rav Tabori in high school telling us this, his son taught last night, the Parsha Shir, like, does anybody really care if you know what Tosfot or Rama, what difference does it really make? You know, yeah, it's nice. I don't want to minimize, of course. He was Rosh Yeshiva, learning Torah is very important. But in terms of the importance of what you have to do with your life and your character development, being a good person. So you don't, you know, one Tosfot left, you know, 50, you know, Daf Yomi. Okay, big deal. I mean, yeah, great. But like, if you're not, you know, it's more important to get to live an honest life, or to get, you know, when we have, 50% of Jews intermarrying and assimilation, like, what are we wasting our time on, an extra Rav Chaim? We should out there in the fields trying to bring people closer to Judaism. That's an interesting question. How do you balance these ideas, right? I think, and the importance of Kiruv, whatever. Okay, that, but in general, but the point being that teaching children is the most noble of activities there can be. It's much easier teaching adults. It's much more enjoyable. It's much more intellectually stimulating. And you don't have, hopefully you don't have kids either, but you don't have any discipline issues. Usually somebody unmutes themselves improperly and answers the phone. Okay. But it's like, you know, how when you teach kids can be not always easy to handle, and they've got other interests and they don't always want to be in school. But that's just I don't think he was really talking about that per se, but that's very true. So when teaching children is the greatest of mitzvot. The Gemara says the world exists because of tinokot. Hevel tinokot shel Beit Rabban. The breath of the Beit Rabban, the breath of the child's school. Tinokot shel tinokot. Babies, their breath. And, you know, I'm just thinking, Hevel Tinokot, it means like when they're talking, you know, they're answering questions. But it also, I think, the word Hevel is nothingness, right? Sometimes the kids are mamish learning nothing. What can you teach a 4-year-old kid? Some, you know, hours and hours and hours to learn a pasuk and chumash. They don't, but it can be Hevel. On a certain level, what they're learning is nothing. But on the other world, on the other level, that's what keeps the world alive. The world is mikayim because of hevel tinokot shel Beit Rabban. The air, even if there's not mamash, like meaningfulness to the air, the fact that they're engaged and will grow up to be, so that's how the world exists. So teaching children is really the greatest of mitzvot. We make fun. And listen, I teach in a high school. I hope that counts as teaching, you know, children, whatever. But, and of course, I much prefer to teach. I don't think I'd be a good teacher for grade 2 students. Like, I like teaching kids in grade 12. They're much more developed. They ask good questions and stuff. I couldn't teach grade 2. It's really, really hard. But it's, in a sense, more important. What's that book? Everything I learned in kindergarten. I don't know what the title of that book was. But you learn who your kindergarten teacher and grade 1 teacher are is really, really important. That's what Elisha ben Avuya is really saying. The Gemara, one of my favorite halachot, I have a few favorite halachot. One of my favorite halachot is if you're teaching Torah, and I think to children, and they come and they make an announcement, they interrupt, you know, important announcements sometimes in school on the intercom, whatever, on Zoom, they break in and they say, please, everybody, the Mashiach has arrived. The airplane to Israel is leaving in 45 minutes, quickly off to the airport immediately. You got to go greet the Mashiach. So the Gemara says, very nice, very nice. You don't go. Somebody else can greet the Mashiach. You're learning Torah. You're learning, kids are learning Torah. You don't interrupt learning Torah. Who cares, the Mashiach? So the Mashiach is there, big deal. You know, that's very nice. It's very nice. Yeah, we pray every day, sort of, the Mashiach, right? People, who, you know, all the jokes, people who don't want the Mashiach to come, whatever. But it's just, it's a beautiful halacha that when children are learning Torah, even for the arrival of the Mashiach, we don't interrupt them. So that's on the most basic level what Elisha ben Avuya is saying. He was talking more on a practical level. You can have much more impact. It's true. It's very hard to change adults. Character is developed at a very young age. And, you know, who are the teachers who really influence? on a person, you ask people, Nobel Prize winners, or ask off, but they'll tell you their great four teacher, you know, who did this. They remember, you know, their great six teacher had us, you know, encourage questioning or whatever it is. It's rare they're going to tell you my university professor. Yes, intellectually, how they got the, you know, the last line of research. Of course, they need the university professor, obviously. But the one who molded their life, that they would be interested in that, that's usually coming somebody from teaching in grade two or four or six. By the time you get even to high school, it's a little bit harder. The kids are formed much more. They have their own opinions, and it's very hard. And to change adults is next to impossible. But okay, Beseder, everything's important. But that's one idea that the Elisha Ben Abuya here was saying. You want to teach young people, we can mold them. Maybe that's not a nice word. You can have a much greater influence on them if you mold them in the right way. It's very important who the teacher is. The teacher has to encourage kids to think and develop and critical thinking and different opinions and all that. You don't want to make a robot. That's what they do in some school systems. They make robots. So that's not so good. They indoctrination. That's not teaching. Okay. But let's spend a few minutes talking about, of course, Elisha Ben Abuya, who is, I'm sure, you know, most people aware, you know, the most famous heretic in rabbinic literature. And he is the teacher of Rav Meir. Last week we discussed Rav Shimon ben Elazar, who was a student of Rav Meir. He's and as well known, he and Rav Meir remained very close. The most famous story, I'm sure many people are aware, that they're walking on Shabbos, and Elisha ben Abuya is riding his horse. Which let's put it in modern terms: Elisha ben Abuya is in the car. He's driving on the car, even though it's not exactly the same technical prohibition. That doesn't really matter. And Rav Meir is walking with him on the street, you know, and everybody's seeing Rav Meir schmoozing the guy, Elisha ben Abuya. You know, he learned in yeshiva. Whether he's wearing, I doubt he's wearing a kippah. I don't know if Rav Meir was wearing a kippah. But anyway, so, and they're schmoozing, and they keep going. And all of a sudden, Elisha ben Abuya turns to Rav Meir and says, Rabbi, enough, you can't go anymore. This is the end of Trum Shabbat. We know there's a rule. You're not allowed to leave the city beyond a certain area. Those of us who live in big cities, even Hamilton qualifies as a big city. Even our small towns, even the cottages, you're not allowed to go more than 2,000 amot. It's a bit less than a kilometer outside of city limits. So that's a law, one of the laws of Shabbat. There's a half of Masechet Eiruvin is how to calculate it. You have to know math a little bit. Do you do it? How do you draw 2,000 amot from where? And is it a square or a circle? You know, do you get the corners? Whatever. A very, very complicated area. Very impractical for most of us. It doesn't really come up, but it's it does come up. You go to your cottage. It can come up in cottage country. You have to be careful that you're walking, or even in camps, to walk outside of the campground more than 2,000 amot is a halachic problem. So Rav Meir didn't know exactly. He wasn't paying attention. So Elisha ben Abuya said, Meir, got to go back. You can't go anymore. So this is like, you know, the guy driving the car and eating on Yom Kippur, and says, Rabbi, Yom Kippur starts in 5 minutes. I'm going to keep my cheeseburger. You got to go to shul, you know. So that's the famous story. And of course, the rabbis are very critical of Rav Meir. How can he do this? How can he learn? Okay, we have another problem. How happy should you be when your enemy falls, and how much can you learn from a heretic? So here again, we have two very contradictory, teachings. So we learn Ezu Hachacham Halomed Mikol Adam. You learn from everybody. The Rambam says Kabel Amet Mimi Shamro, and of course the Rambam accept the truth from whoever says it. It doesn't matter, heretic, not heretic, Jew, non-Jew. It doesn't matter. Whoever says something appropriate to say. That's one teaching, and that's Rav Meir said. It's like when I eat a fruit, I eat the fruit, I throw out the pit. I take the good stuff from Elisha ben Abuya, but the stuff that he rejected, I don't accept that from him. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we have a pasuk in Malachi. We read it I forget now which Haftorah we're reading. Kisif Dekon Yishmeru Daf, the Torah Hashem Yibakshim Yipiyu. The mouths of the Kohen, Kisif Dekon, Kohen, the Kohanim were the teachers of the Jewish people, Yishmeru Daf, they're the ones who guard our religion. The Torah Hashem Yibakshim Yipiyu. And the Torah of God, you should ask from him. Ki malach Hashem hu, because he's an angel of God. And the Gemara interprets, im malach Hashem, if your teacher is like an angel, you can learn Torah from him. And if he's not, if your teacher is cheats on his taxes, or he's not, he doesn't, whatever, he's just a great university professor, but he's not observant, then you can't learn Torah. You can't learn Torah from somebody unless he's malach Hashem tzivaot. So on the one hand, you can only learn Torah from the pious. A Torah is the word of God. How can you learn Torah from somebody who doesn't follow the word of God, who openly rejects it? On the other hand, Torah is truth. How can you not accept truth wherever it comes? So this is, again, a blatant contradiction, which is, you know, the way so much of our Torah is, as we've mentioned. So here too. So here it's, so a number of years ago, I read it a number of years ago, his name slips my mind. He was director of Orot. Orot, we mentioned on Wednesday night, we're talking about Rabbi Berglass taught at Orot when he made Aliyah. Rabbi Felix, Yehuda Felix, I believe, was the founder of Orot. So I forget the name of the person who was running Orot. So he has a fantastic article, like a 40-page article on this issue, examining all the sources and all the historical development and what all the major people had to say about this question. Can we learn Torah from a heretic or not? So clearly, Rav Meir learned Torah from a heretic. And the Mishnah quotes Elisha ben Avuya. Now, this is the only time he's quoted in the Mishnah, but the Mishnah is quoted. And I saw an amazing comment by the Melechet Shlomo. That is Rav Shlomo Adani. He lived in Svat and then in Hebron in the 16th and 17th century. And that was the time, I think I mentioned a number of weeks ago, really Mishnah study took off in Svat in the 16th century and in Europe. And for many hundred, basically from the close of the Talmud, so from the close of the Mishnah or the close of Talmud until the 16th century, the only commentary that we know of written on the Mishnah is the Rambam. Nobody wrote commentaries on the Mishnah. The Gemara was the commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah was never studied as an independent, you know, text. And in the 16th century, in Svat, you know, all the Kabbalists and similar developments in Europe, in Prague, that's when the Tosfot Yontov, Rav Yontov Lipman Heller, wrote his commentary on the Mishnah end of the 16th century. That's when the Mishnah became an independent subject, and I learned Mishnah in high school. We had four periods a week, and I'm a big believer in teaching Mishnah. I like to, we'll learn later in Pirkei Avot, Gemara should begin at 15. Let the kids learn Mishnayos, and until then, that gives them the basis of Jewish life. But it's only really the last few hundred years Mishnah has been studied as a independent subject, independent of the Mishnah. Now, today, there's a whole debate. Can we interpret the Mishnah differently than the Gemara? So already people like the Vilna Gaon seem to imply yes. In other words, that anybody who's learned enough Gemara knows that sometimes the Gemara gives the Mishnah such a far-fetched interpretation. It's like, because the Mishnah says A, and the Gemara quotes a contradiction. We have a contradiction. The Gemara like to resolve contradictions. So the Gemara gives a resolution that the Mishnah is talking about this case, and you read it, say, that's really what the Mishnah means. So many people assume, again, this is a broader subject, many people assume that the Mishnah, it doesn't mean what the Gemara said. The Gemara, so what's the Gemara doing? The Gemara said, if you want to reconcile these two teachings, it's like it's postmodern thinking, right? In postmodern literature, it doesn't matter what Shakespeare thought. Who cares? If you can interpret Shakespeare to mean X, it doesn't matter that Shakespeare might. That's how postmodern literary analysis works, that the words of the author intent is irrelevant. So in a certain level, that's what the Gemara does often. The Gemara said, I'm going to reinterpret the Mishnah in order to make it fit with somebody. Then that's not what the Mishnah meant. It doesn't matter what the Mishnah meant. I can do it. It works. And I think that's what the Vilna Gaon says. The Gemara knew that they were doing. The Gemara knew that that wasn't the proper interpretation. That wasn't the simple meaning of the Mishnah. But that's halacha developed beyond the Mishnah. So sometimes in order to say the Mishnah is not in contradiction to halacha, we reinterpret the Mishnah in a way different from original intent, but a way that's that can be read within the Mishnah. I hope that wasn't too crazy what I said. But anyways, it's a very, so that today, yeah, people, they want to study Mishnah independent of Gemara, meaning they're going to interpret it, even though the Gemara says A. Generally, if you read the Bartanura, the classical commentaries of the Mishnah, they don't do that, of course, as you can imagine. Although sometimes they do, every once in a while they do, they will give a thing, says the Gemara says this, but generally, especially the Bartanura almost never does that. I don't know that he ever does that. He's always quoting the Mishnah in light of how the Gemara interprets it. Kahati, Pinchas Kahati, the classical modern Hebrew commentary does the same thing. He always understands the Mishnah in light of the Gemara's interpretation. Anyways, so but back to say from that aside. So the Melechet Shlomo, then he says he saw in Sifrei HaGaonim. I don't know if it's a book or books. He saw in the writings of the Gaonim that the reason Elisha ben Avuya is mentioned in the Mishnah is as a reward for telling Rav Meir the Tchum Shabbos, that God rewards even heretics who do something right, get rewarded. Everything they do is terrible. No. And he actually quotes, he says to him, Nakuv Shmo Eitzel Chaside Olam. His name will be Nakuv, will be like chiseled in to the pious of the world, that this Elisha ben Avuya, this great heretic, was very pious because he told Rav Meir, I don't believe in Shabbos, but you, Rav Meir, you do believe in Shabbos, you can't go back. And as reward for that, because what are we quoting the words of the most famous heretic in rabbinic literature in the Mishnah? Why? What are we doing here? So you could argue he's here because we accept the truth from whoever says it, but that's what they said. This is a reward. So we have this contradiction of can we learn Torah from heretics or not. So again, and clearly there are different trends in Jewish thought. The Rambam was clearly on the side of accepting Torah from whoever ever teaches it. And today, I think many circles that's not at all accepted. There's the idea we only learn Torah from pious people. Of course, people are going to veer in one of those two directions. But again, the question is, can they and should they be reconciled, these two opinions? Could be they can't be reconciled, nor they should be reconciled. On the other hand, there's much to say that's reconciled. So first of all, I think it's important to point out, I don't think Torah necessarily means knowledge. Torah is a way of life. Torah means instruction, how to live your life. So one could argue that I'm not allowed to learn Torah from a heretic. I'm not allowed to get my life view and my development from a heretic. But knowledge, that's halomei mikol adam. In other words, it's sifte kohen yishmur dava, Torah tashem, the Torah of God. That doesn't mean an understanding of what a Rashi means. In other words, or the historical, archaeological evidence of something or some insight given by, let's say, a non-Jew. Nechama Leibowitz is from the school of Kabbalah Matmi Mishamro. We learn from everybody, and she famously would quote non-Jews. She quoted Benno Jacobs. I bought the book only because of her. Benno Jacobs was a Reform rabbi in Germany, but a tremendous scholar of Bible with great insights. So Nechama was from the school, of course. Generally, listen, it doesn't have to be this way, but it is this way a lot. In the modern Orthodox world, generally, they're much more open to learning from whoever. And in the Haredi world, they're not. I guess that's not a surprising development, but it has nothing to do with that. It's really, you know, how do you understand the interaction between these? So one you can interpret it, what are you learning? Now, it also may be very different in an age where Torah is no longer studied orally from a teacher. Even if we have a teacher, so how much do we learn from our teacher? When Rav Meir and Elisha ben Avuya in the generation, you know, when there was no written Torah, the oral law was oral, and there was no printing and there was no books, the only way you learned is from a teacher. So there the teacher had much greater impact on you. So It could be there's a difference between who your teacher is in the classroom, you know, so to speak, who your personal teacher is, and what you read in a book. I don't know if the guy's true. I don't know that Benno. If I wouldn't know Benno Jacob is a Reform rabbi, I wouldn't know he's a Reform rabbi. In other words, there's nothing in his book. Because he's he's writing a Bible commentary. He's not writing about being a Reform rabbi. So, an Orthodox person can, you know, one can learn whatever. So that could also be another. What's your interaction? The written word or the or word can also define, as we say, Torah is sort of, like I say, character. It's a way of life. It's not about pure knowledge. But that's basically this famous debate. And, you know, Kabbalah met Mishamru. And again, I don't think they have to. I think everybody agrees there are points where we can, there are limits on both sides. In other words, that they're not just blatant contradictions, but there are limits. We can learn from everybody, but you have to know. We have to know what everybody's bias. We know today, right? There is something what you believe in affects your scholarship. Everybody knows that. You know, one of the, I remember Rav Schachter telling us the worst thing about what's awful. If you can predict the rabbi's answer before you ask him, he's no rabbi. And that, in other words, he told, like, if you go to a convention, so they're going to talk about, like, I remember he gave us the example on Shemitah, that the Heter Mechira. So he said, yeah, well, all the Zionist rabbis are in favor of it, and all the non-Zionist rabbis are not in favor of it, like someone who's saying. So he's saying that's a terrible thing. That's horrendous. What should, whether you believe religious Zionism is wonderful or, you know, was whatever you think about it, what does that have to do with whether the technical question about Shemitah b'zman hazeh? Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the rabbi who sort of allowed the Heter Mechira to go ahead, it was before Rav Kook. Modern Haredi, those terms didn't exist back then. It's a technical question. Can you sell the land in Shemitah? Now, it could be today, because if the solution is to get from Arabs in Gaza to get your fruit or something the way it used to be. So yes, there are other considerations, but it shouldn't be that, you know, your hashkafa, your religious outlook is going to influence your halakha, of course, and that's appropriate. But it shouldn't be you know, some issues go beyond hashkafa. In other words, you can have a philosophical view, and then there are halakhic view that doesn't necessarily correspond to what people put together. So the halakha works sort of independently of that. But we all are biased, and we all form our opinions. So it is very important. I think, like all these contradictions, like we asked Rav Lichtenstein, you know, is it better to live in a all religious neighborhood, or is it better to live in a mixed neighborhood with non-religious Jews? And of course, in typical fashion of Rav Lichtenstein, there's no answer to that question. But as he pointed out, whatever you're doing, you have to worry, you have to compensate in the other direction. So if you're living in an all-religious community, you have to expose your kids to non-religious Jews. You have to let them know. And if you're living in a mixed neighborhood where the kids see people driving on Shabbos on the street and et cetera, he's talking in Israel, of course, you know, then you have to compensate otherwise in terms of the importance of learning Torah and Shmirat HaMitzvot. So you have to do both. Rav Lichtenstein himself did both. I mean, he lived most of his life. I mean, once he made Aliyah, he lived in Giva Mordechai, which was a mixed neighborhood. He lived among, so that answers the question already. You know, he raised his kids in an environment where it wasn't a religious shuna. He didn't move to Beit Vegan or Geula or whatever, you know. And then, okay, so when he got a little bit older, he moved to Alon Shvut, where the yeshiva was. Maybe, I don't know exactly the calculations, but obviously older, you know, he used to drive every day from Jerusalem to Alon Shvut, you know, it's a half an hour drive, whatever it is, maybe a little longer in traffic. Of course, that's when he famously said, he would travel with a Jordanian passport if it brought peace. In other words, in the real peace deal, if it meant to have peace, Jordan has control of Beseder. If we can still live there, have a yeshiva, peaceful. But okay, we don't want to get into the politics of the situation. But again, that's a beautiful idea. So, you know, being aware of both, that you want to expose your kids. It's not, you know, exactly what we were talking about here, but you want to expose your children to both sides. You want intense Torah, but it's good to post heretics. I would think today it's good to hear what the heretics have to say. Dama la hashivla, you know, right? That's one of the, also enough in Pirkei Avot, but you have to know how to answer the heretic. So this is again, but Elisha ben Avuya, so that's the question. He is quoted, we can learn, and Rav Meir clearly learned from him. The other rabbis disagreed, and this is an ongoing debate that will never be resolved. And I think, again, there's a lot of personal thing you have to know. Some people, listen, I don't know if my uncle, Uncle Avi, my uncle once told me, I don't know if I ever mentioned, when he went to University of Toronto in the 1940s, so he had to take a course in order to graduate in those times. He had to take a course in Bible. New in 1940s at University of Toronto, Nechama Leibowitz wasn't teaching Bible. Had professor to absolute, totally non-traditional documentary hypotheses, all the classics in biblical criticism. And he said it strengthened his faith. He was forced to confront issues that he never had to confront, and he's glad he was exposed to it. And today, you don't have such an attitude, so unfortunately, I think. But that's exposure to heretics can often be a good idea. But yeah, you have to know, are you ready for it? You have to inculcate it. We mentioned this a number of times. That's why Avraham Avinu moved to Gerar before Yitzchak was born. He didn't want Yitzchak to grow up in a hick town. He wanted to grow in the big city. And you can say that's how Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch explains that they moved to the bigger city, the capital. That's where the king was. If you look in the Chumash, it's clear. Gerar is like a capital city. So that's where he wants his kid to grow up exposed. That's probably why we formed this nation in Egypt. God wanted us to see the greatness of Egypt and also to reject their immorality. Greatness and immorality sometimes can go together. You can be the greatest country in the world and a low-life country. We know countries like that today that we see all over around us, great in one area, but their morals are not so great. But we need to be exposed to the greatness. So that's you have to be exposed to that, and that's why we had to grow up in Egypt. We had to become a nation in Egypt. Okay, but that's again a very important subject, very important in our time where there. And I say Baruch Hashem, there are so many people who are not observant who learn Torah. That's a wonderful thing. People who. And of course, we don't really have heretics anymore. What does a heretic mean? But that's a different story. I guess I'll end this part of the discussion with the quote I always love to say of Adin Steinsaltz. I believe his first Yortzeit was just about a week ago. Adin Steinsaltz mentioned when he was interviewed by Time Magazine. Time Magazine quote said that a mind like Adin Steinsaltz comes around every 1,000 years. That's what they said about him. But I don't know that Time Magazine is, Torah Misinai, but Adin Steinsaltz was a great, great person. And so they asked him in the interview, he says, I don't understand. You grew up in a non-observant home. How come you dedicated your life to the study of Talmud? How does somebody coming from a non-religious home dedicate their entire life to the study of this obscure ancient text, So he said, I quote it all the time. I tell my kids in chat this all the time. I love it. He said, my father was not religious, but my father believed, you have to be educated. My father says, I don't care if you become an apikoros. You can become a heretic. That won't bother me. But no son of mine is going to be an amaretz. But I'm not going to let any of my child be an ignoramus. You want to become an apikoros? Become an apikoros. But first learn. First learn Torah. And it's such a beautiful, not that I want people to become an apikoros, but it's really a beautiful sentiment. Okay, let's just, Elisha ben Avuya saying, but you should teach kids. I was thinking, I don't have a clear link, and maybe you do, or if there's really a clear link between Elisha ben Avuya's life and his teaching, right? Like I mentioned by Shammai. Shammai says, "Havi mekabel kol adam b'sefer panim yafot," accept people with a gracious smile. And we know, I think Shammai was talking to himself because of the famous stories with Hillel and Shammai, the potential comrade came and Shammai threw him out of the house and Hillel was nice to him. I think, and we know Shammai had a rough personality, but it's the Gemara says it, the sages say, you should be a nav like Hillel and not a kapdan and not somebody who says in the patience for people and, like Shammai, you shouldn't be like that. That's what the Gemara says. Okay, everybody has things there. Nobody's perfect. So I think Shammai was talking to himself that it's very important to accept people and smile. So you have that a lot, I think. I mean, that's also, some people don't like that method of interpretation. But of, I think it's normal. That's your personal thing. But some people, you know, no, how can you take any personal things into their teaching? So I don't know if this teaching of Elisha ben Avuya, that you should teach, you know, children. Teaching children, you can have a real impact. Teaching adults, it's much harder to have an impact. That's what he's saying. I'm not sure that is at all connected to his, the trajectory of his life. And of course, there's a whole debate. Did he ever repent and do tshuva? Could he do tshuva acher? He's known as the other one. And whatever it is, there's much more to discuss. If anybody's read As a Driven Leaf, of course, which is by Milton Steinberg, right, who was a conservative rabbi, I believe, who wrote the book As a Driven Leaf, sort of a historical fiction recreation of Elisha ben Avuya. Okay, but then the Mishnah continues. Rav Yossi bar Yehuda ish kfar habav liomer. We'll just get started here for a minute or two. Halo meg mina ktanim. Now we're talking not so much who you teaching, who your students are, but who's your teacher. So this is very interesting. This, to the best of my knowledge, is the only debate in all of Pirkei Avot. We're going to now witness a debate in the Mishnah. I cannot think of another Mishnah. We'll pick up on this theme, please God, next week, why there are no debates in Pirkei Avot. Like the whole Mishnah, everything's a there are no arguments. And even here, the argument is not directly said. But Rav Yehuda, ish kfar habav liomer, halo meid min haktanim. One who learns from little people, from young people, ktanim, lemahu dome, what's he like? Le'ochal anavim kehot b'shotei yom migito. It's like he's eating unripened grapes and drinking wine from the barrel, like before they bottled the wine, right? Va'olo me'min haskenim, but one who learns from elders, lemahu dome, le'ochal anavim b'shulot. It's like eating ripened grapes. B'shotei yom yashan, and drinking old wine. Everybody knows aged wine is so much better. So don't learn from young people. They're inexperienced. You need time to ripen. You want somebody who's experienced, right? You can't become president of the United States before the age of 35, right? You need a certain age. You can't learn Kabbalah at the age of 40, whatever it is, right? Learn young people, no matter how brilliant they are, they're unripened grapes. They don't have life experience. And you learn a lot from life experience. That's why the Gemara says you have to honor even idolaters who are elderly. Person who the Gemara assumes elderly, maybe people won't like this, is over 60. People 60 and up, that's the general. Right? You have to honor older people. So what's the definition of a seva? So most authorities assume the age of 60. You have to stand up. And then Rav Yehuda says, "Afilo zaken ashma'i." Even there's a debate, Rashi and Tosfot, exactly what that means. Let's assume it means even an idolater, even a non-Jew, because life experience, anybody who has life experience, they have what to teach you. That's, if you take that interpretation of that, even a non-Jew, even an idol worshiper, that would seem to go with the view that you can learn Torah from anybody. But that's the idea. So old age, we honor old age. We'll pick up on that a little next week. And then Rebbe says, Rebbe, the author of the Mishnah, Al tistakel b'kankan, a famous quote, don't judge a book by its cover, basically. Do not look at the barrel, ela b'mash yeshbo. Look what's inside the barrel. Yesh kankan chadash malei yashan. There's a new barrel. There's a young person full of old wine, the yashan. And there's an old barrel, afilu chadash eimbo. The Hebrew is so beautiful. Even new wine you don't have in this old barrel, right? Don't look at, it doesn't matter how old the person is. It matters the quality of the person. Okay, so here you have, it seems to be a debate between Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda and Rabbi. If your teacher, nobody argues with Elisha ben Avuya. Everybody understands that you can have much greater impact on younger students than an older student. That there's no argument. But whether your teacher should, how old your teacher, of course, there are many other factors, but the idea is that, you know, you need time to develop, and nobody should get a teacher's license till they're X years old. Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, so that's the Mishnah. Okay, please God, we'll pick up on this theme next week. Okay. Just let's do a very quick review. So we discussed Shmuel HaKatan and the whole idea, should we rejoice or not rejoice the contradiction between being Fole Becha Al Tismach and Vavod Rishayim Rina. We should be happy when there's evil people will suffer. Is this a contradiction? I mean, it is a contradiction. Can it be resolved? Is it two various opinions? It depends how evil the person is. How do you define evil? If it happens to you, as opposed to the angel singing, is no good. But we who suffered by the Egyptians, we can sing. We said this is not a practical. Shmuel HaKatan is not giving a utilitarian approach that we shouldn't rejoice when our enemy falls. It's a moral character. It's a moral wrong to be happy when somebody else is suffering. And we discussed the concept of a ra lishma, a sin done for the sake of a noble purpose. Like Yaakov Avinu tricked Yitzchak, that was an avera lishma. And but he was happy that Esav suffered a little bit, you know. So that was shelo lishma. So we had to suffer 1500 years later in Shushan. How hard it is, even on fear. In theory, an avera lishma is greater, or at least as great as a mitzvah. Shelo lishma, intent is very important on the one hand, but it's very hard, next to impossible, to do a real avera lishma. And then we discussed, of course, the whole debate about Elisha ben Abuya. Must we learn Torah from heretics or not? We only learn Torah from angels of God, and how do we resolve the contradiction? Again, how much should we resolve it? And depends what type of learning. How do you define what Torah is? Knowledge and not the Torah. Torah might be a way of life, but it's all Torah's developing our character. That's to say, you know, that's so it's very important. And how does reading books influence all that? And because people put their own personal views into books also. It's not like a book is independent of the author. We don't live in such an impossible for a human being to be so pure. So it's not a simple question to know what. And then we discuss, of course, you want to teach young people. You want to be able to have a real influence. And it's hard. It's hard. The older we get, the harder it's to change. And I don't think I mentioned, right, the Rambam says, doing tshuva, we're coming to Elul. Next week is Elul already. It's hard to believe. So it's too early. It's always too early, but this year it's really too early. Yes. The Rambam says it's more important to do tshuva, not an action. Hey, Don Korte, you talked a little lashon hara, whatever. But what's much more important, what's much harder, much more impactful is to do tshuva on our character traits. Not to be greedy and not to love money too much. That's what the Rambam writes. The love of money, character traits, that's much, much harder. And as Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, it's easier to learn the entire Talmud than to change one character trait, right? Habits are formed, but it's more important. And with that, we'll end. And please God, we'll see you next week. And before then, Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag is... If we continue a series on Sefer Devarim. Monday, Rabbi Nishira continues her series on rabbis from the Islamic world, Shira Mervis, and then Rabbi Alex Israel is finishing his series on Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, going a different book, his seven-part series. And as I mentioned last night and Wednesday night, on Tuesday, my brother from Kedma, a student organization based in Israel, will be conducting an interview doing it jointly with Yaakov Katz, the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. So you can go online for that. I just read actually today an interesting article of his. Like I mentioned, he's an observant Jew. He's a firm guy. I think grew up in the States, and now he's the editor of the Jerusalem Post. And so that should be interesting, a little bit different. These are not you know, like a regular shear, but to, you know, talk to interesting people in Israel. So that's going to be Tuesday, 1 p.m. Okay, I see there's a question too. Yeah, great book, as a driven leaf, right? Elisha ben Avuya is not listed as a rabbi. Somebody wrote me. It says, right, we don't call him Rebbe Elisha ben Avuya. That's interesting. I never thought of it. Presumably it's related. He never got smicha. Nobody ordained him as a rabbi. Although, I don't know, maybe, but how did he be Rav Meir's, you know, teacher? Did they take away smicha? The Malamid Lahol, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, and the greatest like posek in Germany at the turn of the 20th century. Rav David Zvi Hoffman, he's not as famous as he should be, but he has a tshuva about that, rescinding smicha. You can be disbarred, so why can't you be disrabbied? You know, everybody knows you can disbar me. So, but whatever. So that's an interesting point. I never thought. Yeah, I imagine even Rav Meir, Meir maybe called him Rebbe. I don't know. But the rabbis, they quote him, but they're not going to call him rabbi. He's such a famous heretic. I don't know. It's an interesting point. Okay, what about the best traits in Avot Debeit? What are you referring to? I assume when I said there's no machloket, where, oh, yeah, that's when Rav Yochanan Ben Zakkai asked, what are the best traits? I hear that. Yeah, okay. I don't know that I would call that exactly a debate. It was each student was expressing what they thought is most important. It's not quite the same way as a debate. I don't think they're arguing in the same way, like on Ayin Tova versus, you know, or a Lev Tov or a Chaver Tov. What's more important, a good heart or a good friend? I don't know if that's a debate in the same way. Yes, a little bit. This is like really a debate. Should you learn Torah? If you learn Torah from young people, you're eating unripened grapes. It's bad. And the other said, no. You just look at what it is. So that's interesting. The Lo A's, the English term calls him rabbi. Okay, any other questions? Does intent play a part? Adults have more of intention to learn. Yeah, for sure. Can you... I'm not sure what you mean. Can tinokot are babies? Yeah, tinokot means young children. So the Gemara says the world exists because of the hevel, the nothingness, right? The hevel, but the Torah they speak, even if it's really on an unsophisticated level of tinokot shel baby. Of course, babies can't learn on a high level, but it means young people. Yes, Gemara says as soon as a kid knows how to speak, you have to teach them Torah tzibalanu Moshe. So even babies or really little children. Tinokot in that context of the rabbis means little children. Okay, I think I got to all the questions. No, especially wicked, especially far away, and not your direct enemy. Did not do anything that affected you directly. Correct. I think that we mentioned there is a difference being happy with a wicked person who inflicted harm on you versus the inflicted harm on somebody else. Your attitude should be different. That is correct. Okay, everybody, Shabbat Shalom, all the best. Mr. Zucker, you want to say something?
Please, about possibility of Nazis doing tshuvas. Now, help me here. There's a famous story about Kohen Gadol who was murdered in the Mishkan, and blood started spurting out of the ground. And who was the governor of
Rome? Yeah. When they came in.
And how many people would
Titus, I'm sorry, not in the first temple. We have it in the keynote because the blood of Zechariah that was seen by the rabbis as retributions that the Jewish people had killed the Kohen and the Navi on Shabbos Yom Kippur in the Beit HaMikdash.
Yes. And so the governor of was it Babylonia, who Roman governor was the
Babylonians.
He kept on killing people until and in the end it happened not just did he do tshuva, actually he was misguided. He became Jewish according to
the Gemara says that the Bnei Banav Shel is it Nebuchadnezzar or Bnei Banav Shel Haman are learning Torah in Bnei Brak.
I heard that he himself, what happened, that he actually, according to one version, one story, one midrash, became converted to Judaism.
Yeah, so I don't remember the whole Midrash, right? But I know if we were referring, right, the Kina that we say, and he the blood, and he sort of turned to God, said, how much do you want me to kill everybody?
Yes.
Let it stop already. And he turned to God. Did he himself be Midrash? Could be. Listen, I don't know what to say. That's why Rav Soloveitchik didn't answer the question. There is no answer. How can you forgive a Nazi? Can you forgive on the other hand, maybe they really do want to change. Maybe they do feel terrible about their past.
But this governor, listen, the first Yom Kippur, he must have been doing lots of clapping, you know?
People do terrible things. Sometimes the more, that's the whole idea, that when we say about tshuva, that a sin can be converted to a mitzvah. It's a very difficult concept. How can a sin be converted to mitzvah? So the psychological explanation is pretty simple. The harder one falls, the greater one can rise.
If you
take the energy, or as to put it like, right, the power of hate is the greater than the power of love. We all know that. The desire to do wrong is much greater than the desire to do right. Mm-hmm. So we want to hurt somebody. We're much more into it than we want to help. Say, help him, okay, I got a flat tire. I couldn't make it. A flat tire is not going to stop you if you want to hurt somebody. So if you can take that power of sin, the power of sin is greater than the power of mitzvot. So if a Baal Teshuva can take that power of sin and convert it to mitzvot, then that sin becomes a stepping stone to mitzvot. We all know that. We all know Balei Tshuva, they're more, and some of them are much more intense than we are. You know, we're like born, we're FFEs, you know what I'm saying? Well, you know, so we know we can talk in davening a little bit because that's just what religious Jews do. Don't give me all the stuff that's in the books. You know, there's sort of what's written in it. There's a way we're brought up. Yeah, Kiddush Club, we have all this stuff. And the Baal Teshuva comes and he's like, he learned, you know, davening before God. They sometimes have an attitude that's much more pious because they're coming for, they have missed all these years and they want to transfer all that energy. So sometimes somebody who was a murderer can become, I mean, it's a little hard often, but we know the alcoholic can become the greatest person teaching against the dangers of alcohol. That we know. So often this sin really is a stepping stone to mitzvah, that we're coming up to Elul. It's a hard concept, but that's you know, I'm sure there are Nazis who feel terrible for what they did. There's some who are unrepentant, but there were some weren't. And we know there are Hamas terrorists. What's his name? There's a guy who wrote a whole book, right? He left Hamas and became very pro-Israel. And, you know, people change. People wake up. What can you say? Thank you. All right.
Jay, interesting story, related story about the guy. Two guys who come to the Rebbe and says, how do we do tshuva?
Okay.
So the Rebbe says, so what did you do? So one guy said, well, I did something terrible. I killed someone. So the Rebbe said, well, you go out to the field. You bring back the biggest possible rock that you can find.
Okay.
And the next guy comes to the Rebbe and said, what do you do? Well, I'm not sure. I'm sure I did a lot of little different things, but, you know, I can't really put my finger on them. So the Rebbe said, you go out to the field and you bring back as many little pebbles as you can.
Right.
Right. And then they come back to the Rebbe, this guy schlepping this boulder, this other guy with the, you know, pockets and bags full of little pebbles. So he said, okay, Rebbe, we did what you said. Now what's the next step? The Rebbe said, now go back to the field and put the things back exactly where you found them.
Right.
So the guy who picked up the big boulder knew exactly. I mean, there was a hole in the ground. He put it back and whatever. And the other guy had no clue where to start.
Right. So, correct. Often it's much easier to do tshuva from the big things. You know, it's wrong. Very good. Yeah, 100%. Yes. 100%. The little things. Yeah. Okay. All right.
I need you to be in touch with me about my son's yahrzeit. It's the end of Elul.
Okay. I was just about to say, so fine. Thank you very much. I was saying, you were in the midst of our Elul program. We're putting, I have a few people, I'm juggling a few balls. Hopefully over the weekend, I'll sort of put it all together.
We'll try to see. We want to dedicate something.
Yeah. I know. Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
Have a good
Shabbos. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Okay. Have a great Shabbos, everybody. Bye-bye. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.